I'm very happy to have this opportunity to celebrate 25 years of Abhayagiri Monastery with you all. I'm here at Amravati. I feel this the seat that I'm in is kind of like a pilot's chair, since I'm in California, but I'm also been leading events in Geneva, in Delhi, in Kuala Lumpur, and then people joining in from all around the planet. Probably this evening, there's quite a few people from many different countries around the world plugging into this. So I am very happy to be in this pilot's chair once again, and to be sharing this opportunity with you. It's afternoon in California. Here in England, it's just after 9 o'clock in the evening. It's getting towards midsummer, so it's still broad daylight here. Very early mornings and late evenings at this time in southern England. So recollecting the foundation of Abhayagiri, I was chatting with Ajahn Yaniko before, you know, saying, what would you like me to talk about? You hum it and I'll play it. So I could talk about a great variety of different things, but I thought perhaps something of the origins of the monastery would be helpful to address first of all. Without going into too much, I know I'm prone to giving more detail than necessary, so with that in mind, I'll try to keep to the essence. But I would say it, Abhayagiri really began with Lumpur Sumedho responding to invitations from Jack Kornfield to go to California and teach when Jack had moved over from Insight Meditation Society, and he would invite Ajahn Sumedho to teach in California each year. And then Lumpur would go and visit his parents, who were living down in San Diego, and his sister and brother-in-law were there as well. So through the early 80s, 81, 82, 83, 84, and so on, Lumpur was coming to California every year. And it was quite clear by the time he got to the mid-80s that there was a number of people who wanted to practice beyond the bounds of just the meditation retreats or listening to Dhamma talks, but wanted to, I'd say, have a monastery and the sort of full spectrum of the Theravada mode of practice in their midst. And so that by the time we got to about 1986, then Lumpur felt there was a group of people gathered in the Bay Area who really understood what monasteries were for. They had a good sense of what he was teaching and were keen to have a monastery founded in their area. So we first heard about this in England at the full moon gathering at the end of the winter retreat in 1986. And Lumpur Sumedho made the statement to the community that he was open to the idea of starting a monastery, first of all in Switzerland, where he'd been visiting for many years, and also in California. So that was the first public statement, sort of dropping the, not exactly the cat amongst the pigeons, but certainly casting the bread upon the waters. Maybe that's a better way of talking about it. So that that was really the first time the idea of a monastery in California was launched into the group mind. So a few times during that period from the early 80s, Lumpur Sumedho had spoken of his association with Master Xuanhua and the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and how within that Northern Buddhist tradition, there was very close affinities, the style of practice, even though they had some different scriptural background in terms of their sutras. The Vinaya practice was very, very similar, and also the use of the austere practices, what we call the Dutangas, was very, very close. It was very much a Dutanga tradition, say, Buddhist monastic community. So there was a lot of empathy and a mutual understanding, mutual respect that had grown up between the community of Ajahn Sumedho, Amravati, Chidhurst, the branches that were being established here in Britain and Europe, and then also with that community in California. So that took shape in the late 80s, with Lumpur Sumedho being invited to help conduct an ordination ceremony. Master Hua is a monk who, even though we don't handle money, he puts his money where his mouth is, and he wanted to have he got permission to be a preceptor. They organized an ordination ceremony at City of 10,000 Buddhas, and they paid for tickets for Lumpur Sumedho and 9 other monks to fly over to California to join in with the ordination ceremony. So that was like the first time our communities came close together as a larger body of people. And then the following year, Lumpur Sumedho invited Master Hua and a large group of his Sangha to come to our monasteries in England. So those of you who've seen photographs of Master Hua and nuns and monks from his community at Chidhurst, Amravati, that was 1989, was the large visit to these communities. So that really brought us closer together as a kind of a pair of ventures. The momentum for developing a monastery then at the same time that was growing, I think it was December of 1988, Lumpur Sumedho sat down with half a dozen people in San Francisco, Mark Lieberman, Debbie Stamp, Daniel Barnes, Zena Janowski, Zita Rothman, and I think Susan Barber was brought in the last minutes. I think she might be listening in this evening. I think I'm not sure if she was there at that first meeting in 1988, but she was eventually brought in as a board member. She often would say that she came along to cook the meal. Didn't have much of a connection with Theravada Buddhism, but she liked these monks. She came along to offer the meal, and somehow she found herself a board member by the time the meal was over. Debbie Stamp can correct me on that if I've got the dates and facts wrong. But anyway, that was the December of 88, Sangapala was formed as a little charitable trust create the ground for making an invitation for the community to begin. So that then, developed. And then in 1990, Lumpur Sumedho made a visit with two nuns, Ajahn Sundra and Sister Jyotika, and myself to the Bay Area. Previously, I hadn't been involved at all. I'd been around with Master Hua and the community coming to visit England, but there was quite a number of American monks in our community. There was Ajahn Nando, Ajahn Satyajito, Ajahn Prabhakaro, there was also other senior teaching monks. Ajahn Sujito had been over to America once or twice. Ajahn Kirisara was a gifted teacher, also American. So I had no clue that I was going to be involved in this project at all, because I assumed that if Lumpur Sumedho starts something up in the States, an American would be one who leads it. But so I was sitting having a cup of coffee with him sometime in late 89, as I would often do, pop around after the morning meditation and sort out monastery business. And so we're just chatting with him, and he was planning this visit in 1990. And he said, I'm going to take a couple of nuns, and then I'll take one of the monks, and then we'll come back to England, and I'll leave the monk there to have a temporary vihara in San Francisco, and we'll see how things go with the idea of a monastery, see whether the Californians really take to that. And I blithely asked the question, so who are you thinking of taking along? Which monk are you thinking of taking? And he looked at me and said, actually, you, Venerable. So that was a surprise. And so I realized my fate/karma/calendar was going to be tilted in that direction for time to come. So just to then briefly cover the following years, I came with Lumpur that year, and then 91, 92, 93, 94. Then I would come for a few months each year, the Sangapala, Debbie and Mark Lieberman, Susan Barber, Daniel Barnes, and other members of the group would very diligently set up a temporary vihara in San Francisco. I'd come over, I would teach in the city, give a few day-longs, and then go back to England. So it was Also at a time of great change and a bit of turbulence in our community, a number of the senior Ajahns had left during that time. Quite a number of the Americans, Ajahn Prabhakaro, Ajahn Santajito, Ajahn Kittisaro, they all disrobed during that time. So there was a reticence to be committing to a new monastery right away, very quickly. So we weren't in a hurry. But by the time we got to May of 1995, then things were calming down. There was a bit more cohesion in the community. And at a Sangha meeting on May 31st, 1995, it was discussed about the idea of a California monastery. And the Sangha said, okay, Ajahn Amaro, we think things have come together sufficiently that you can go over there. Maybe you really should have four monks to start a new monastery, but you can go over there maybe with one other monk and start looking for a place. So I thought, oh, sātu, sātu. That was May 31st. June the 1st, so early the next morning, we got a phone call from Lumpur Sumedho, who happened to be in Long Beach visiting Master Hua, who was extremely ill. And so I was walking down the corridor in the monk's vihara. Ajahn Viradamo called me into his room and said, Ajahn Amaro, we just got a call from Ajahn Sumedho. Master Hua wants to offer us 120 acres of forest in California. What do you think about that? And I said, well, that was quick. So less than one day after the Sangha had agreed that we could start looking for land, Master Hua, from his deathbed, offered 120 acres of land for our community. So the search was very, very brief. There was no search at all, in fact. And that was the half of the land that now constitutes Abhayagiri. It's the northern half of the land that doesn't include the little cottage and what was the cottage and the original barn and so forth. So that was an incredible gift, totally unexpected, out of the blue. But then we came over for Master Hua's funeral in 1995. He passed away, and then in July we gathered for his funeral at City of 10,000 Buddhas, and I took the opportunity to go and visit the land, and I think Fred Kral and Debbie and myself were taken over the land by Skip Blake, who was the realtor, who was a disciple of Master Hua, and climbed up the various trails through the creeks, covered in poison oak, literally crawling under the manzanita bushes, all the way up to the top of the ridge. I think we nearly killed Skip along the way. He was not really quite as young and spry as the rest of us. Debbie will, I'm sure, remember that particular adventure quite vividly. But anyway, it gave us a feeling for the land. There was no well, there was no electricity, no phone, and a washed out access road. So I thought, perfect. You know, it's incredibly rugged, is a really steep, many kind of dry creek beds and convoluted corners of the valley. But I thought, for a forest monastery, this is perfect. This is a really beautiful wild forest, never really been logged to any great extent. Unfortunately, no water, no power, no access, no buildings, but, you know, details. So that was a wonderful gift. We realized very quickly that we couldn't move onto the land. There was no water, so you couldn't even camp on the place. And so Master Hua, they'd owned the property for more than 12, 13 years, and they'd only ever camped for a few days, a few months at a time, because of no water and very, very limited amenities there. So anyway, it became clear that if we wanted to develop the place, we needed to get some kind of a pied-à-terre, some sort of launch pad nearby. So we started to look around, and then along the way, while we were exploring the property, we had inadvertently crossed over into what is now Casa Serena. That was the property belonging to Mary Curran and Peter Lariviere, Dr. Peter Lariviere. And we found one of the buildings on the land actually had a Thai Buddhist shrine and a Thai Buddha Rupa in this building on the land. So we thought, oh, well, at least the neighbors seem to be Buddhist. That's a good sign. And there was a Christian monastery also just next door. So we eventually got in contact with Peter LaRiviere and Mary and said, you know, are you interested in renting out your property, or, you know, could we possibly think about buying that, because we need to develop this land and we have to have a place to begin. And they said, no, this is our place. We're sharing it with four or five other families and people. So, you know, please, we're happy for you to be next door, but no, this is our place and we want to keep it. So then we approached the neighbor on the other side, which was a man called David Flum. And he had 128 acres with a little cottage and the garage and the strip of land that went all the way up to the ridge. And so he told us, and Sangapala was quite impoverished at that time. So the annual budget for Sangapala's entire activities was about $25,000 for everything, if I remember correctly. So it didn't have very much in the way of funds. But David Flum said, you can buy it or you can forget it. He wasn't interested in renting it. So that was what do we do about this? So, but it looked absolutely ideal. It's, you know, where the main buildings are, where many of you are gathered right now, that was the property where David Flum was established. So it had water, it had some buildings, it had the access to the land, it had the main creek. So it was really perfect. It was what was sort of completed the sort of two halves of the bowl, but Sangapala had no money. So we thought, okay, well, let's ponder what we should do about this. And then a gentleman, Kun Jarun, a Thai gentleman, who was a businessman, said, well, my business is quite prosperous and I'm happy to give you a loan for a few years, and so that you can use that to buy the property. So again, this is how I'm remembering it. So we thought, well, that'll be helpful. And the reason why it was a bit of an issue when we had to buy the whole property was because we very quickly found out that banks don't loan to churches. But we thought, well, you know, it's California, I can put a little bit of a small down payment and then get a mortgage and pay that off. And then we found out very quickly, no, you can't. You have to come up with all the money to buy it, because banks won't loan to churches, because they will always, it's very difficult to foreclose on a church or a religious group. So we had, Sangapala had to find all the money to purchase the property. Anyway, so Kun Jarun stepped up, and so then Sangapala was happy to then start making arrangements, and they went into the purchase process. So during this time, again, not to get lost in too much detail, I went traveling with Lumpur Sumato to India. He was responding to various teaching invitations. We went to Thailand, we were in Indonesia, and then along the way, I think when we were in Indonesia, we got a fax from Kun Jarun saying, terribly sorry, my business is not doing very well. I won't be able to lend you the money. My apologies. I hope that's okay. Right. So I was writing a lot of faxes during this time. Those of you who remember fax machines. But I didn't have any, I had a feeling that things would work out. I had no clue how they would work out, but Sangapala was already in escrow. So he had a commitment to buy this place and had had very little in the way of funds. A couple of people had very generously donated quite a bit to move things along. If I can mention Suhineya and Judith Stronach, were both very, very generous and helped to oil the wheels substantially, but they still needed to find about another $140,000, which was not inconsiderable. It was a very substantial amount of money to find. So anyway, traveling with Lumpur Sumato, going here and there, wondering how things were going to work out, we went to Wat Pananachat, and then there was a young American who was visiting Wat Pananachat, and he said, I hear that you're starting this monastery in California, and I had a house next door to my home that I was expecting my mother to use, but that's not going to be working out. So that house is now available for me to sell. If you need to if you need any money for helping to purchase the land, I could loan you that for a couple of years before using the money to help my mother get established in a care home. So I thought,
Thank you very much.
so that miraculously came through. He didn't know how much the house was going to sell for. He was in Thailand at the time. Cut a long story short, he went back to America, put the house on the market, the house sold, and it was just about the right amount, together with the funds from the Sangapala had. It came to the purchase price for the land, which was $180,000, or just shy of $180,000. So that all came together by amazing, again, rather like Master Hua offering the forest a day after the Sangha agreed. Even though a few weeks before, Sangapala had very small amount of funds, they managed to close escrow only 2 weeks late. So it was originally supposed to close in the middle of May, and it closed at the end of May instead. And so on May 31st, which happened to be Visakha Puja in San Francisco at Mark Lieberman's house, then a person very familiar to you, now known as Ajahn Kurundamo, became Anagarika Tom on Visakha Puja, May 31st. So exactly 1 year after that Sangha meeting. And on June the 1st, we rolled wagons and loaded up with what possessions we had for Sangapala in terms of Dhamma books and shrine gear and a tea cozy. The first possession that Sangapala had as a monastic possession was actually a tea cozy, acknowledging the British connections. And so June the 1st, we rolled up to Redwood Valley and moved on to the property. By that time, the only people that I knew, again, slightly miraculously, I'd been out to Mendocino County a few times over the years, usually to Fort Bragg and Casper to give teachings over there. So most of the people in Mendocino that I knew were on the coast, in Fort Bragg, in Albion or Casper, Cleone. And I only knew one family in inland Mendocino. And they were the Malans, if I can mention names, and they lived in Redwood Valley. So when we got the offer of the forest from Master Hua, and I saw the address, I thought, Redwood Valley, that sounds a bit familiar. I looked up in my address book, and lo and behold, there were the Malans in Redwood Valley. So they were very happy. We moved into their backyard, and by the time we rolled up to the little house on June the 1st, then I believe the Malans were already there, and Jeannie Bendick, who also was one of the board members of Sangapala for a long time, I think even the president for quite some time. It's all back in the mists of time now. Jeannie and Dee Cuthbert, and I think the Malans had all been scrubbing vigorously, tidying up the house and helping us to move in. So that was June the 1st, 1996. So that was how the whole thing came together. The role of Lumpur Pasano was that he had approached me a couple of years before, about 1994, and said that he was interested to leave Thailand. He was getting very wrapped up in the bureaucracy of the Sangha, and it was he really wanted to carry on living as a forest monk and not as a sort of as a public figure or as a involved in the Sangha administration in the way that was happening in Thailand. And he asked if he could come and help out with this venture in California. He was a bit shy to ask. Maybe he told you that already when he spoke yesterday. He was a bit kind of hesitant. He's 5 years senior to me, and it was sort of my show, and he didn't want to steal my thunder, as it were. You know, we're not allowed to steal as monks. So he was cautious of intruding on my patch, and so, but he sort of hummed and hawed a bit and said, "Yeah, would it be okay if I, offered to help out?" And I said, "Yes, sadhu, thank you, great, fantastic." So I was extremely happy to have him on board, and I felt very, very confident that it was a good combination, because I'd literally known him since my very first week in the monastery in Thailand. Also, even though we have quite different characters, I'm very kind of wordy and kind of business oriented in terms of administration and collecting facts and living with agendas and minutes and meetings quite comfortably. And he was much less wordy and less of an administrator and more of a Dhamma practitioner and Dhamma teacher that I can characterize us in that way. I felt that it was a really good mixture. He was quite quiet, and I was a kind of loudmouth, but he was extraordinarily inspiring and say committed as a Dhamma practitioner, and very knowledgeable about community life, very knowledgeable about developing living places and community. And I hadn't had to be in a position of leadership to really be in that kind of a role in the past. So it was fantastic, really, for me to be able to draw upon his wisdom, his experience, his skill, his incredible clarity and commitment. So I was amazingly grateful that he volunteered to step up, and I had no difficulty whatsoever with him being senior, and we decided we'd try a co-abbotship. And also, I borrowed a leaf out of Master Hua's book, because those of you who've been to pujas at City of 10,000 Buddhas will notice that when they finish the puja, they would they recite the names of Master Hua's teachers, and they include two monks who are called both called the Lord High Master of Three Conditions Monastery. So my understanding is, when Master Hua was a novice, he was at a monastery with a co-abbotship. There were co-abbots of Three Conditions Monastery in Harbin in Manchuria, where he was a novice. And so I sort of thought, well, if he could have a co-abbotship. And he pointed out in a number of his teachings, he was really impressed how these two elders worked harmoniously together, and there was no jealousy or competition between them. So I thought, well, maybe Ajahn Pasno and I can do that, and let's give it a try and see what happens. So that was we kind of, neither of us had done that before. We were sort of jumped in and hoped for the best, and I feel it worked out very, very well to the benefit of the community and also for each other, that we greatly enjoyed that collaboration. Over those early years, I also, along with people like Jeannie Bendick and Dee Cuthbert and Debbie Stamp, Susan Barber, I'd also like to mention Rick Williams was extraordinarily helpful. He was always around, lending a hand. Again, very, very quiet, but he was a can-do kind of a guy. When we were given the Buddha Rupa that sits on the shrine on the hillside, he literally drove his pickup up the hillside to help get the Buddha Rupa in place, if I remember correctly, and was very, very generous and helpful in those early years. Also, David Dawson. In the very first few days, myself, Ajahn Visuddhi, and then the then Anagarika Tom, now Ajahn Kurundamo, in the very early days, just the three of us living at the monastery, this local fellow, maybe a week or two after we'd arrived, this man sort of came and knocked on the door, came and visited, and it turned out his brother had been a bhikkhu in Sri Lanka. He himself was a Buddhist, and in conversation with him, he said, "I like to build huts and make pathways through the forest. If I can help out, just let me know." So I thought, well, thank you very much. That's you couldn't have made it up, really. I mean, if he had made it up, no one would have believed it. But anyway, this local fellow who's a Buddhist who builds huts and knows how to make trails so through this very steep, rugged landscape that we'd inherited. The group of us, Ajahn Visuddhi, myself, and Anagarika Tom, as he was then, Ajahn Kurundamo, were not particularly practically gifted. Probably Ajahn Visuddhi had more building experience than the rest of us. Our entire toolkit was one small Swiss Army knife and a hammer when we arrived. That was our workshop. But it was enough to put up a post box and to, to get things going. Also, people gathered around. The Malans were incredibly generous with their time and tools and their help. Peter was very, very generous with lending a hand on the practical front. Richard Smith in Detroit cast around through his friends, told them that a monastery in California needed all kinds of tools and equipment. He literally filled up the back of his van and drove from Detroit to Abayagiri and then provided all kinds of good things like a table saw and a washing machine, all these, I think a drying machine, all these kind of good things. So during those first years, one of the things I thought I should also share is that the ethos that Ajahn Pasuna and I had and also had developed, because I'd been teaching in the Bay Area for about 5 or 6 years by that time. I first came in 1990. And my initial thought was, well, it's the Bay Area, and they have this kind of really colorful spectrum of spiritual teachings. They've got every kind of Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Vietnamese Buddhism, Ram Dass and Vedanta, and the all kinds of colorful spiritual groups, Swami Muktananda over in Emeryville, on the East Bay, the Sufis and, anything and everything, and the Christians next door. And so I thought I should provide this kind of colorful array of spiritual teachings. So kind of the first year I came, and I suggested I could give talks on this and that and this and that, and one of the members of the Sangapala board said, Ajahn, maybe if you just taught Theravada Buddhism, that would be great. But people didn't want to be entertained with a kind of spiritual smorgasbord of tasty delights, but they wanted the monastic-based classical Theravada Buddhist teachings and meditation guidance. And so that was really helpful. I mean, I have an eclectic kind of a mind, and I can dip my toe into all sorts of areas, but it was really clear that's what the group wanted, was monastic-based classical Theravada teachings, guidance in meditation, and wanting to support and to be able to stay in a monastic environment in the forest. So by the time that Abhayagiri, the land was given, and Ngunpor Sanno came, which was like New Year of 97, about 6 months after I arrived with Ajahn Kurundamo and Ajahn Visuddhi, it was really clear that what we were not trying to, it wasn't sensible to try and be all things to all people, but it was really, and both Ngunpor Sanno and I kind of were really in accord on this. We just do this one thing and try to do it well, create a Theravada forest monastery based on the teachings of Ngunpor Cha and the forest Ajahns, based on Dhamma Vinaya as we've been trained to live in kutis in the forest and to practice meditation and to live together harmoniously. Just do that. If people want to be part of that, they can come and join in. If they don't want to be part of that, if they want to do something else, then sadhu anumodana, please have a nice life doing whatever it is that you want to do. And I feel that was a really, I mean, I'm not sort of praising myself, but I feel that was a wise decision, because as most, many people who live in California or have lived in California, the Bay Area, things can get spread pretty thin, and you can get pretty scattered with all of the good and wonderful things available. And you can get kind of confused between Advaita Vedanta or Bhakti Vedanta with Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, mystic Christianity, Sufism, and all and everything that's available there. And so that I feel that that was a wise decision, and I felt no regret over the time that I was there at Abhayagiri, and I'm very pleased to see things carrying on in that vein, because trying to be all things to all people, it comes from a kind of an idealistic position, but the practicalities and what's really valuable is just do one thing well. Do what you do what you know, do it well. And then those who have affinity with that or can empathize with that, they'll draw close and they'll be benefited. And if there are people who can't benefit from that or they don't like it or it doesn't suit them, fine, there's X plus one other opportunities for them to draw upon. There's many other flowers in the garden. There's many other, avenues for spiritual practice. So that that ethos also, I'd lived at Amravati for 10 years prior to coming to Abhayagiri. And we had, at that time, there were no kutis. Everyone lived in buildings with, you know, in rooms. This was a converted school. So one of the ethics of Abhayagiri and my kind of founding principles was no corridors. No rooms on corridors. Everyone's in a kuti, and we all live in the forest, and everyone's in a kuti. And so that was something I wanted to put in place. And again, Lumbar Prasanna was very much in accord with that. So that's what that dictated the style. So even though the land is really rugged and it's really hard work to put the kutis in the various different corners of the forest, and some people have got a long hike, you know, like a half mile hike and a 400 or 500 foot climb to get back to your kuti. That is also something that I feel has been a real benefit over time. And one of the things I said that is a contrast to Amravati is in living in a Abhayagiri, it's almost impossible to stay stuck in your head. Because if you're up in your head, you'll fall off the path and roll down through the poison oak, and it'll be with you for the next 3 weeks. So you have to keep your mind and your body and your attention on the ground. You know, where are you putting your feet? And so that it's a very physical teaching. It's a physically demanding environment. Also, the heat of the summer and the temperature differential between night and day. You can't ignore your body. You're always putting on layers and taking them off during the course of a day. Here in England, I'm not criticizing England at all, but you can put on one set of clothes in the early morning, you wear the same stuff all day long, and you feel comfortable all day long. It's like the temperature, it doesn't vary that much. Whereas a Abhayagiri, that you're very, very conscious of being a body that's meshing with its environment, and the air temperature around you is continually changing. So that is another of the aspects of Abhayagiri life that I found was really helpful. So there's the steepness, the ruggedness of the land, the size of it, you know, 280 acres of forest now. Oh, and the land across the road as well that's been acquired. That there's a physicality to the life that's really helpful. You know, it's kind of kayan upasana, mindfulness of the body, is an absolute necessity. And that's very good for people, the majority of people coming from a middle-class, intellectual-based life and education. It's good to have a need to come out of your head and be in your body and to relate to Dhamma practice in that very engaged physical way. Also, it's not just a retreat environment, but also that the quality of community that is there is very much a part of community life. Many people who are coming along to events and teachings in the Bay Area, even after I talked about the monastery as a project over and over again for quite a few years, when we actually started Abhayagiri and people realized, oh my goodness, so it isn't a retreat center. You can't come and do a retreat there. I said, no, it's a community. Oh, really? So what about retreats? I said, well, we'll do one retreat a year, you know, one 10-day retreat. But, you know, we're not about doing retreats. We're a community. Like, oh, really? Oh, my goodness. And isn't it inconvenient for you to be so far away from the city? Say, no, it's good that we're far away from the city. That means that people have to make an effort to get out there. You can't just, it's not something that you're tacking on to your ordinary everyday life as an urban Dharma buff, urban Dharma buff. But, you have to go to it and give yourself to it. It's deliberately not convenient. That's part of what it is. So you have to, those of you who are in the Bay Area, have to schlep up Highway 101 for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, 3, 4 hours, depending on traffic. But that's good. An effort needs to be made to get there. So you're leaving your familiar zone behind, the kind of habits and attitudes that form your persona, your self-view of you as a city dweller. That has to be left behind by the long journey up the highway, or even across from Fort Bragg on the coast. It's an hour and a half winding through the hills to get there. So that's there's an effort that has to be made to arrive at that place of practice. Maybe the last area to talk about. I mean, there's many, many things I could talk about how things developed over the from 2000 from 1996 when I moved there to 2010 when I moved away. But one of the things I think is helpful is that, again, I didn't see the invitation to Amravati coming. I didn't see the invitation to California coming. And yeah, I didn't see the invitation to back to England. I knew that Lumphor was keen to retire, and I thought about other people who might fill in. I was really well settled at the Bayagiri, and I'm really enjoying collaborating with Lumphor Phitsanulok. And we had a great little thing going, and we just built this our perfect cooties up in the forest, and the kind of ideal living spaces. Even had an indoor bathroom. Didn't have to have the usual mode for a Bayagiri cooties is a pit toilet out in the forest. So we had, and then hot and cold running water in the cootie, a toilet and the shower in the cootie, with solar powered electricity and so on. So the perfect cootie, beautiful view over the valley. So it's just so perfect, so wonderful. I forgot that the thing that made it really perfect was that it was Anicca. That was the final perfection is that it's not permanent, and it's anatta, it's not mine. And so then it was in the latter part of 2009. I was with Lumphor Samedo Wat Pananachat, and we just had a Sangha meeting there. And he said, "Oh, the meeting had just come to an end." And he said, "Could you come by my kuti after the meeting? There's something I wanted to chat with you about." And I thought, "Oh, we've been to Egypt together. We've been to the Arctic together. We've been to Japan together. Where next? Paraguay, the Galapagos, maybe Mongolia. Who knew what he? I was literally was thinking along those kind of lines. I wonder where he's been invited to now. Thinking it was like one of these sort of Dharma jaunts. Been to Bhutan together as well. So, or maybe we're going to China, mainland China. That would be interesting. So again, I was completely clueless. I went over to his kuti, and he said, "I'd like to invite you to be abbot of Amaravati. What do you think about that?" Oh, well, thank you very much, Lumpur. So then I said, "Well, I think my first thought is I better have a conversation with Ajahn Pasno." So anyway, I felt very honored and touched that he would ask me to do that. I was, in retrospect, I really should have seen it coming, but I didn't. But anyway, I got the invite to do that. And so then the next morning, preparing for alms round, I think Lumphor Phitsanulok and I were putting our robes on, and I broke the news to him. And so, just as I had felt, Lumphor Phitsanulok's first reaction was like, "Oh, well, I feel happy for Amravati, but that was a shame. I was enjoying that. We had a good thing going there." But it was about 13, 14 years we collaborated at the Bayagiri. But I felt, like Master Wah, put your money where, well, we don't handle money, but put your monk where your mouth is. I thought we talk about Anicca all the time. We talk about Anatta, all dhammas are not self, that there is no owner to anything. So how possessive do I feel for a Bayagiri? Can I just pack up and leave. And so that was between that December when the invite came, and then we were still traveling for a bit. And I wasn't until, I think, end of January that I got back to Abayahiri, and then we sort of broke the news to the Sangha that I had this invitation. I had to discuss with the Sangha at Abayahiri whether they approved, whether they were going to let me go. That wasn't a sure thing. But they agreed. But then that 6 months of saying goodbye and packing up, that was a very interesting time, that in the sense of ownership or history of how much I'd been involved, or how much I'd presumed that I was going to be living in this kuti up in the forest, and that we, Lumpur Pasando and I, would both end our days on that hillside. Then realizing, well, that was just a presumption, and life is full of surprises. Let go. So it was a very kind of refreshing and interesting kind of practice. It was a feeling of shedding, letting go, giving away dozens of books. You can see that I'm still, I continue to attract books to me wherever I am. But we're leaving Abayahiri, giving away to the public library and all sorts of different places, giving away lots of books, giving away things. And so when I left, I just had one small suitcase and my bowl and my robes. And that was what I left Abayahiri with. And July of 2010, and arrived back here in England at that time. But it was a kind of death experience, but as Lumpu Cha would say, die before you die, Dai God Dai. But yeah, that I was identified with that. I had a sense of ownership or assumptions, and here it's going, it's leaving, it's cheerio, goodbye, farewell. And so there was a sense of loss, or a sense of shedding, but also almost in the same breath, a kind of spaciousness and a relaxation. So, there's a refreshing quality to that shedding, that letting go. And I feel that's very much the flavor of Buddha Dhamma. And I feel maybe that's a good thing to reflect when we are leaving things behind, our faculties of hearing, our intelligence, our memories, our homes, our partners, our jobs, our money, our reputation. When things leave, our mobility, our eyesight, our hearing, the things that we think are ours and who and what we are, as they go, then there is a sort of, oh, not that one too, or oh, I thought that was mine, or oh, yeah, that there is that kind of quavering, or that flavor of grief, in a way, as a tone of grief, but its partner is joy. That it's like an in-breath and the out-breath, that they go together. And I feel that's very much the flavor of Buddha Dhamma. It's a bittersweet flavor. And that, yes, there's a bitterness to that letting go of what you thought was yours, or who and what you are, but there's a sweetness in exactly the same moment. That's the tone and the flavor of Dhamma, is a bittersweet quality. So people ask me, do you miss Abayahiri? And I say, no, actually. I forget you exist most of the time, to be honest. And when people say, do you miss Ajahn Pasno? You were together for so long. And I say, no, when we're together, I'm happy to spend time with him, and we have a great time catching up, and we enjoy each other's company. But if he's not around, nothing is missing. And for some people, that feels really hard-hearted or callous or sociopathic. But it doesn't feel that way to me, really. And that, the fact that, June, to be honest, June the 1st passed by last week, and I totally forgot that it was Abayahiri's 25th anniversary. The birthday went by, and it was... didn't even cross my mind, June the 1st on the calendar. So whether you find that refreshing or depressing that I completely forgot you, Personally, I take that as quite a good sign that I'm not so attached to the place that June 1st is, you know, the anniversary day is sort of inked in and sort of underlined three times in red. But just no, it passed by, just an ordinary day at Amravati. And then it was Ajahn Kachana saying, oh, Abhayagiri has got this 25th anniversary event. He's got 9 days of teachings. Did you know about that? And I said, no, I didn't actually. So, what are they doing? And I thought, oh my goodness, it's right, 25 years, it's June the 1st. That was, wow, that was a few days ago. And so I feel that sense of non-ownership is, that's one of the characteristics of Nibbana, akinchanang anadanang. When the Buddha said there is an island, it is a place of no thingness, it's a place of non-possession. Anadanang is non-ownership. I feel that's a place of peace, of not owning our living places, our relationships, our faculties, our ability to see and hear and even to think. If we establish that attitude of non-owning, then when it's around, we're quite happy for it to be there. And if it's gone, there's nothing missing. So that I feel that that sense of not missing you. Again, you might feel, oh, Ajahn, don't you miss me? Sometimes people will ask that. Did you miss me, Ajahn? If I say, no, actually, I didn't. The people can be offended, but I mean that in a good way. It's like I'm not carrying people around. And or people will say, I bet you're really happy. Lumpo Samedo is back living in Amravati. I said, well, I'm very happy for him to be here. So, did you miss him when he was in Thailand? No. And that, again, people will think, how can you not miss Lumpo Samedo? It's like, well, in exactly the same way. If he's here, I delight in his presence, but I'm not kind of counting the days that I can go and chat with him again, or I'm not fearing the day that he's going to die. It's like when he's around and when we're together, that's delightful and wonderful. But when the day comes that he dies or I die or there's another separation, that's the way it is. As he says over and over and over again, it's this way. It's like this. So I see that I've spoken for about an hour now, getting on for that. So I offer these words, these memories for people's consideration. And also thank the many, I mentioned a few names, but also those whose names haven't been mentioned, who had many parts to play. Sadhu Anumodana. Also the many devas pulling all kinds of strings along the way, whatever devas have been involved in helping this to happen, sadhu anumodana, and much appreciated. And may the first 25 years just be a tiny little moment in the long and beneficial future of Abhayagiri's presence in the world.